get some sleep. But she needs to reassure herself that this time, they got things exactly right. The case depends on it. Detective Holloway's job depends on it, too. She presses play. The camera lens rests on a girl with the lean muscles of a swimmer and a feathery pixie cut. She sits all the way back in a wobbly metal chair, olive skin covered in denim and soft cotton. She tugs on a long-sleeved gray shirt, bunching the sleeves in her hands. To the girl's right sit her parents and a solemn-faced lawyer. Hollow circles line the woman's eyes. The man shaved before they came here, but he missed a few spots. Across from the Spanos family and their lawyer, Detective Holloway sits with A.D. Massey, their hands propped on a thin metal table, a new addition to the room. A.D. Massey pushes his rolling chair 2 inches forward, then 2 inches back, then 2 inches forward, then 2 inches back. You can start at the beginning, Aster, Detective Holloway says gently. A small twitch in her jaw betrays how hard she's working to keep her voice free from its characteristic edge. The girl takes in a deep breath and scratches absently at the skin where her shirt's neckline hits her collarbone. Her mother gives her leg a reassuring squeeze.
I guess it started over Thanksgiving break, almost a year ago. Zoe was home from Brown, and things were weird with Caden. She wouldn't talk to me about it, but I could see the hurt all over her face. That Saturday, Caden was hanging out with friends in the city. At least, that's what he told Zoe. She spent the afternoon visiting Mrs. Talbot at Windermere, which wasn't unusual. They were really close. But when Zoe came home that night, she was in tears. She locked herself in her room and wouldn't talk to me. The next morning, she went back to Brown.
We weren't aware, Joan Spano starts to say, but A.D. Massey silences her with a raised hand.
This is Miss Spanos' statement, he says. We need to hear only from her.
George Spanos takes his wife's hand in his, and they both nod at the detectives across the table. What happened after Zoe returned to Brown? Detective Holloway asks. Aster sighs softly.
I snooped around her bedroom. She'd taken her computer, obviously, but I found some flash drives in her desk drawer. On one, there was a series of photos of Caden with this pretty girl I didn't recognize, and also a bunch of emails that had been cut and pasted into a Word doc. The photos were all saved with Saturday's date, and the most recent email was dated November 28th, Thanksgiving Day. So it was all really recent, and I figured that must have been what made Zoe cry.
Did you tell your sister what you'd found? Could she confirm your suspicion? Detective Holloway asks.
Not directly, no. Like I said, she wouldn't talk to me about it, which is how I knew something was wrong in the first place. She must have pulled the photos and emails from Caden's laptop while she was visiting Mrs. Talbot. If I hadn't found the flash drive in her desk, none of this would have happened.
Aster's chin quivers, and her voice catches. Her mom squeezes her leg again.
If I could go back, I'd never look in Zoe's room. That's what I wish, more than anything.
From two seats over, there's a loud choking sound, and George Spanos raises a tissue to cover his mouth. The lawyer busies himself with his notes.
What happened next, Aster? Detective Holloway asks.
Over the next couple weeks, I tried to get Zoe to open up. Caden was hurting her, and she was just letting it happen. I never told her what I'd found because I knew that would shut the conversation down. I tried to get her to tell me herself, but she pretended like everything was fine. When Zoe came home for winter break, I thought maybe things would change. But Christmas came and went. Nothing. If Zoe didn't want to tell me, fine, but it was increasingly clear that she wasn't going to confront Caden. She always wanted to make everyone happy, and he was taking advantage of how good she was, that asshole.
Aster's voice rises, and she drops her shirt sleeves to clench the arms of the chair in her fists.
Sorry, she adds, eyes darting to her parents. She draws in a breath, then turns back to the detectives. The thing is, I've always looked out for Zoe. She was the best person in the world. But she didn't know how to put herself first.
Go ahead, Detective Holloway prompts gently, keeping the conversation going.
When Caden texted her from the city on New Year's Eve, ditching their plans for that night, she told me she needed to be alone for a while, that she was going to take a walk on the beach. She'd been crying.
Tears well in Astra's eyes, and she scrubs a sleeve across them.
I couldn't let her keep doing this to herself. It just wasn't fair. So I decided to send Caden a message. Punish him.
Astra's lawyer clears his throat, but doesn't stop his client from speaking. Joan's fingers dance nervously along her collarbone. Okay. What did you do next? Detective Holloway asks.
I went over to Windermere.
Did you have access to the grounds?
Like, permission to be there? No, but it's easy to get onto the Talbots' property, Astra replies. All you have to do is squeeze through that overgrown privacy hedge out front. They were still in the city. There was no one around.
And where did you go once you'd entered through the hedge?
To the stable. Caden used this stall in the back as a kind of hideout to keep booze there.
You'd been inside the Talbot stable before?
A couple times, when we were all still at Jefferson. I knew about his hiding spot. I would have left the flash drive in his room if I could, but I didn't have any way inside their house. So I put it right next to his whiskey, where I knew Caden would find it. It was supposed to be an anonymous warning that someone knew. He wasn't getting away with it.
And what happened next?
I went home. Zoe got back a little after I did and locked herself in her room. She left for Jacob Traynor's party around 9 that night, as everyone knows. I hung out with my friend Martina for a while, but she had an 11 o'clock curfew, even though it was New Year's Eve. Her parents are strict like that. After Martina left, I couldn't sleep. I stayed up in my room watching crap on Netflix. Around 1, I got this gut feeling something was wrong. I started feeling guilty about leaving the flash drive in the stable. I still wanted to punish Caden, but it was Zoe's relationship. I knew she'd be furious when she found out what I'd done. I wasn't going to be able to sleep anyway, so I snuck out, borrowed our parents' car, drove over to Windermere. I could have walked, but like I said, I had this icky feeling in my gut. I wanted to get there fast.
Astra takes in a shaky breath and looks down at her mom. The older woman nods at her daughter, giving her tacit maternal permission to go on.
When I got to Windermere, Astra continues, I knew something was wrong. The stable door was open, and the light was on. I started running, but I was too late.
Astra's voice catches, and she drops her face into her hands.
Zoe was on the floor, and she was so cold. She wasn't breathing. There was an empty bottle of whiskey on the floor beside her, and the flash drive was gone.
She looks up, straight into the camera.
Zoe never drinks. I can't emphasize this enough. She never drinks. It never crossed my mind she'd go to the stable that night. I swear.
But she did, A.D. Massey says. What happened when Zoe arrived, Astra?
Don't answer that,
Astra's lawyer cuts in.
My client couldn't possibly know what happened before she arrived, detectives. I'll rephrase, A.D. Massey says. He turns to Astra. I want you to put yourself in your sister's shoes. What do you imagine happened when Zoe got to the stable?
Astra's lawyer holds up his hand, but Astra speaks anyway.
It's okay. She went there with that Max guy, like he said she did. It makes sense. She was hurting, looking for a distraction. but then she must have seen the flash drive. It had these yellow and black polka dots. It was pretty distinct. She would have known right away that it was hers. Maybe she thought Caden had found it in her room and taken it to his hiding spot for safekeeping.
Could you smell alcohol on Zoe when you found her? Detective Holloway asks. Aster nods. Please answer verbally for the recording, Aster.
Oh, right. Yes, I could. There was an empty whiskey bottle right next to her.
She glances at her parents again. George is staring hard at his shoes. Joan hastily swipes tears from her eyes, then takes Aster's hand.
She must have, I don't know, gotten alcohol poisoning or overdosed on her anxiety meds.
Aster's chin quivers, and the tears pooling along the rims of her eyes spill over. Detective Holloway pushes a tissue box toward her, and she takes a fistful. After a minute, she says,
"By the time I got there, she was gone. It was just her body left on the stable floor."
The detective clears her throat and adjusts her position in her rolling chair. "Did you move Zoe's body, Aster?" Aster nods, then says yes before they can prompt her.
"I panicked. My sister was dead because of me. I was scared of everyone finding out. My parents, my friends, the police. All I could think was that Zoe was dead, and it was my fault. People couldn't know what I'd done."
"You didn't make your sister drink, Aster," Detective Holloway interjects. "That was her decision. Concealing a body is a felony offense in New York State. Are you sure there's nothing else you're not telling us? If you're protecting someone, we can help." Aster's lawyer shifts in his seat. His client shakes her head back and forth.
"I'm not protecting anyone," she insists.
Detective Holloway and A.D. Massey exchange a look. "All right," she says. "Tell us how you moved her body."
"I buzzed the entry gate open from the inside and drove the car up to the front. Then I carried Zoe around the side of the house and laid her out in the back seat. She was heavy, but I managed. I never even thought about going back and cleaning up in the stable, but I guess Caden did that for me. I just knew I had to get Zoe away from Windermere so no one would find her. I kept thinking over and over, I can't get caught."
"What happened after you placed Zoe in the back seat of the car?" Aster takes in another shaky breath and reaches for a fresh tissue.
"I don't think I had a real plan until I got to the marina. I pulled over to the side of the road and dug out Zoe's phone. Then I bought a Greyhound ticket. I picked Asbury Park because I figured it would lead people off track. I was thinking, I'll just make it look like she ran away. For a while, I think I convinced myself that's what really happened, that Zoe made it to Philly, that she was living a new, fabulous life and laughing at all of us."
"But you knew that wasn't true, Aster," the detective says. Aster dabs at her eyes.
"It was a fantasy, but I wanted to believe it. It was a story I told myself to keep from completely falling apart."
A.D. Massey rubs his hand across the back of his neck and begins his back-and-forth shuffle with his rolling chair again. Detective Holloway leans forward. "What happened after you bought the ticket, Aster?"
"After that, I turned her phone off and drove around for a while. I didn't know what I was doing, but I had to get her body out of the back seat. I wound up in Parrish Park. The gate was open. You're not supposed to be there after dark, but it was New Year's. It was totally vacant when I got there, though. It must have been close to 3 a.m. There was a motorboat on the shore, on the far side, by the Arling windmill. I guess somebody had been partying there earlier, brought the boat and then left it. There were bottles and cans all over the grass. The place was kind of a mess. Detective Holloway and A.D. Massey exchange a look. They're seeing that quite a few things worked out in Astor's favor. There had been footprints and tire tracks all over the place. And besides, no one had thought to look for Zoe at Parrish Park. Everything is so agonizingly clear in hindsight. "Tell us about the motorboat," the detective says. "It wasn't really docked, just wedged halfway on the shore, halfway in the water. When I saw it, I knew what I had to do. That's how it felt. Like this was the solution, the only way to make it all go away. I drove the car across the lawn, right up to the shore, and got her body into the boat bed. I was so nervous someone would see me, my whole body was shaking. But I did it somehow. Adrenaline, I guess."
"And how did you sink the boat?" asked her.
"I started hauling the biggest rocks I could find from the shore and putting them all around her. They looked like gravestones."
Astor's voice is becoming hollow, her eyes a little vacant. "Are you sure the rocks were from the shore of Parrish Lake?"
A.D. Massey interrupts. "Yeah," Astor confirms. "From the shore."
The detectives exchange another look. The rocks found in the boat bed were indeed from the lakeshore, not from Windermere, as Anna had initially claimed. The truth makes Detective Holloway's skin itch. So much of Anna's story had held water. Until none of it did. "What happened next?" she asks.
"I didn't know how heavy I had to make it for the boat to sink. But finally, I ran out of big rocks. And I knew I just had to do it. We had a tire iron in the trunk. And I swung it at the body of the boat a few times until it made a crack that looked big enough to leak."
Next to her, George puts his head in his hands. Joan holds her daughter's hand tight, but she's staring at a fixed point on the station ceiling.
"There was a weather tarp on the shore near the boat," Astor continues. "Whoever brought it out to the lake in the first place must have taken it off. I guess they'd taken the boat out earlier and then just abandoned it. Anyway, I fastened the tarp over the bed of the boat until it was totally secure. Then I started the motor, put it in the lowest gear, and shoved it off from the shore. At first, I didn't think it was going to sink. It got pretty far out, and my heart was beating so fast I thought it was going to explode. But then some water must have gotten in through the crack. And then more. And then the boat just went down. All at once." For a moment, the entire room is silent. Even A.D. Massey has stopped rolling his chair back and forth on the linoleum.
"Is there anything else you'd like to tell us, Astor?"
Detective Holloway asks. "I know I shouldn't have taken the flash drive from Zoe's room or left it in the stable. But I could never, ever have thought that she'd find it or that she'd drink that night. I never wanted Zoe to die. I wanted Caden to fess up, apologize. It was all for Zoe. Everything else was just panic. I'll never stop being sorry."
Chapter 33. October, Bay Ridge, Brooklyn, New York. "You have to tell me. I've been home for less than 48 hours. Mom took a couple days off work to be with me. The Justice Fund she started online covered most of my legal fees, but she can't afford to stay home and babysit me for long. For now, though, it's fine. I'm not ready to go out, face the neighbors' gawking eyes. But now it's late, and Mom's inside watching one of her shows, and Kaylee's here, sitting with me on the fire escape. It's chilly, but not too cold to be outside. Mom made us hot chocolate, a surprisingly maternal gesture, and it feels weird to be sipping the sweet, milky stuff from thermoses instead of our usual vodka and juice. Weird, but good. Kaylee sighs and leans her head back against the brick. I wanted to, she says after a minute. I tried to get you to come home so we could talk, but you went to the goddamn cops instead. I know. You have to understand. You didn't remember. For months, you didn't remember anything. We thought it was the best thing, Ian and Mike and me, to just let you forget. But then I did. I started to remember. And you got everything mixed up. So enlighten me, Kay. Tell me what happened on New Year's. Kaylee takes a long, slow gulp from her thermos. Then she closes her eyes and begins to talk. I close mine, too, and the night plays across the back of my eyelids like one of Caden's movies, dancing vividly across the screen at Windermere. It's New Year's Eve. We are in Star's apartment, and I can scarcely keep my eyes open. I drank too much too early. I'm curled up on her worn blue couch in my party dress, and Kaylee's crouched in front of me, trying to jam my feet into the clunky winter boots I insisted on wearing out tonight, so I won't ruin my flats in the snow that will freeze onto the sidewalks in a thin crust tonight before anyone tackles the cement with shovels and rock salt in the morning. Come on, Anna, she says, irritation lacing her voice. Party time. I manage. Everyone wants to go out on the beach. Get up, baby girl. You'll get a second wind. She gives up on my boots and slides in next to me on the couch, then sweeps the usual tangle of hair out of my face and tucks it behind one shoulder. You coming? It's Mike's voice. I blink once, twice, try to look up at him. He won't come into focus. All I see is a blur of fist bumps and chin thrusts that make Kaylee burst out laughing. Yeah, we're coming, she says. Seriously, Anna, you have to wake up. 15 minutes later, we're on the beach at Coney Island, huddled on the stretch of sand between the murky gray water and the creaky boardwalk planks. To our backs, beyond the boardwalk, is Luna Park. Its rides shuttered and silent in the deep winter chill. It's 10 o'clock, give or take. Too early to go dancing, but too late to sit around inside, waiting for something to happen. Ian takes a pull from a pint of cheap whiskey, then passes the bottle to Kaylee. The cold keeps me awake, but barely. I force myself to look around. We're not the only people out here tonight. A few yards down the beach, far enough away that they look like children under the glow of the lamps on the boardwalk, a group of guys is using the old playground equipment cemented into the sand like their own private gym, doing chin-ups on the handlebars and push-ups against a metal rail set into the ground. A few shops on the boardwalk are open, and people lick swirl cones despite the cold. There's no swimming here in the off-season, but the beach isn't closed except in the area where we've made camp. Our stretch of sand is marked by a few red flags that whip and snap in the wind in an attempt to keep people off the wooden pier that stretches like a bony finger out into the ocean. We shouldn't be here, but who gives a fuck? The deep shadow keeps us ghosted in the night, veiled from the prying eyes of cops or drunk old men. I'm going polar swimming, Star announces, pale hands and face flashing in the moonlight. Mike snorts, You're crazy. Watch me, Star says, and starts out toward the pier. But we don't watch her. Mike's phone rings and he holds up a finger, one sec, then walks down the beach toward the playground. Kaylee spreads out the blanket she's had wrapped around her shoulders, and she and Ian collapse back on the sand, a blur of hands and lips and tongues. I leave them to their grope fest. Up on the boardwalk, arms resting on the rail, is a boy I recognize from around. We've hooked up before. His hair whips into his eyes, then away from his face, reminding me how cute he is. Maybe one time last fall, I stayed the night at his place. I think he was nice. I wander across the sand to the boardwalk. I know you. He's looking down at me. I doubt he remembers my name, but I don't remember his, so we're even. He crouches down so his face is level with mine through the railing. He holds half a joint out to me, and I take it. For a minute, we smoke in silence, passing the joint back and forth. I tell him the name of the club where we're going later, and he types it into his phone. Maybe I'll see you, he says, and when my lips curve up into a smile, the muscles feel tight. Where's Star? Kaylee's voice filters through the thin night air. She's close and far away at the same time. Something's wrong with me. I feel a little bit like I'm floating above the ocean and a little bit like I'm buried deep under the sand. I force my fingers to flex, and I'm not sure what I'm touching. It's soft but gritty and a little damp. Anna, wake up. It's time to go, and we have to find Star. Kaylee's hand is on my shoulder, shaking me. Her voice booms in my ear as if through a megaphone. Not so loud, I mumble. I peel my eyes open and wait for the world to come into focus. I'm on Kaylee's blanket, sprawled on my stomach. For a moment, it's a magic carpet, and we're soaring high up in the clouds. I try to concentrate. That joint was laced with something. I don't know what I'm on. I get my elbows under me and push myself up halfway. Kaylee's gone. I look around until I find her, running out along the pier. Star! She yells. Holy fuck, guys! I shove myself to a sitting position, then to my knees. Someone's pulling me to my feet. Ian. His eyes drill holes into mine. Hello, Anna. You are deep in a K-hole or something. Am I? I mumble. Special K. Ketamine. Maybe that's what cute guy's joint was cut with. Kaylee's voice floats down the pier across the sand. This is her coat. Her dress. Oh my God. In a minute, Mike's next to her. Calm the fuck down, Kay. I force myself to start walking. The ocean gleams with the dull grays of storm clouds or car doors below me as I stumble down the pier, Ian trailing behind. When we get to the end, it all snaps into focus. Star's coat, dress, and shoes lie discarded on the boards. Her giant satchel bag is nowhere to be found. Kaylee has her phone pressed to her ear with one hand, the other dancing nervously against her thigh. She's not picking up. God damn it, Star! She's fine, Mike insists. She's messing with us. How do you figure? Ian asks. Mike shrugs. Her bag's gone, right? Either she went swimming with her purse or she brought a change of clothes. Wouldn't be the first time Star's pulled some stunt. We're all silent for a moment. Mike's not wrong about the satchel bag. Unless, of course, someone stole it. But did any of us actually see her go in the water? My legs buckle, and then I'm kneeling at the edge of the pier, staring out. The water is cloudy and impervious. It's easy to believe, Mike. To believe Star's fine. Standing on the boardwalk at our backs, laughing at us. Because if he's wrong, we're all to blame. We all heard her say she was going in, and none of us checked on her even once. I stare hard at the water until I think I see the flash of a girl's hand break the surface, and I gasp. Star! I scream, and then Kaylee's hands are clasped tight around my wrists, and she's pulling me back from the edge. Because there's nothing. Just greedy, murky water that foams and froths like a hungry wild thing when it hits the legs of the pier below. You passed out in the lift, Kaylee is saying. Her chin is trembling, but her voice is steady. On the way to the club, Mike insisted we all still go, even with Star missing, that we should all just act normal. He'd convinced us, mostly, I guess, that it was probably a joke, and if it wasn't, that calling 911 would only get us in trouble. If she was out there, it was too late to save her. She takes another slow pull from her thermos. I called anyway from the club bathroom, told the dispatcher I'd seen a woman swimming off the pier, hung up without giving her a name. She turns, looks me in the eye. Even then I knew. Too little, too late. Where was I? Where the hell was I? You never made it inside the club, babe. You passed out completely in the lift, and then I got you into a green cab headed home. I closed my eyes again. The cab smelled like Indian spices and old leather. I think I remember that, but I can't be sure. I lean my head back against the brick wall behind us. Kaylee's words swirl all around me, inside me, cutting deep. Star. And I let myself remember. I remember the water, the wind slicing across my cheeks. I remember the darkness, the wet mist in the air. I remember staring out across the water, knowing deep in my bones that this was no joke, that my friend was out there somewhere, a girl's body lost beneath the waves. I remember the guilt, because we didn't even try to help. We wanted to believe that what Mike said was true, because the alternative was too horrible to consider. And so I didn't consider it. I let the truth get snared in cheap whiskey and weed and whatever else. I let it lie dormant at the back of my mind for months, unacknowledged, unexamined, until I came to Heron Mills. Until I learned about Zoe. Until the two stories, girls snatched by dark water, became inexorably tangled in my mind. I let Mike convince me that Star moved to Orlando the next week. He said she got a job at one of the theme parks, and it started right away. And I believed him. Why would he lie about something like that? And no one looked for her. Not all girls have a family like Zoe's. Star had been estranged from her since she was 16. Because of us. Because of what we did. No one even knew she was missing. Star always talked about moving south, where it was warm. I missed her. I hated her for not writing back, not keeping in touch. But mostly, I was happy for her. Kaylee reaches out her arms, wraps them around my shoulders. I fold my head into her hair, her neck, her chest, and then I start to sob.
Chapter 34. October. Heron Mills, New York. Caden's late. After school on Tuesday, Martina waits in the newer of the two coffee shops on Main, at a table near the door. She clicks her nails against her mug, an oversized ceramic bowl with a black and pink houndstooth pattern. This place is cute, but the coffee could be stronger. She taps her phone, checks the time. He's not really that late, only a few minutes. She was early, is nervous about seeing Caden in person. Now that she's here, she just wants to get it over with. It's been 5 days since Martina and Aster went to the ruins of the Windermere stable.
5 days since they were brought to the station for questioning, and Martina was swiftly released after Mrs. Talbot declined to press charges for trespassing. A small mercy. Mommy and Dad were still furious, of course. She's grounded until further notice. Is only here right now because she lied about an after-school project. She checks her phone again. If Caden doesn't show up soon, she'll have to leave. She only has a few minutes. Esther's arraignment was yesterday. She's grounded too, but at least she's home, not in juvie. Martina hasn't been able to reach her friend. Knows she's been charged with concealing her sister's body, but not much more than that. She saw the officer collect the earring from the stable floor. She knows Esther was interviewed that night, and that she returned in the morning with her parents. That sometime after they left Windermere, Esther changed her mind about coming clean. Hey. Martina's head snaps up. Caden is pulling out a chair, unwrapping a scarf from around his neck, and sliding into the seat across from her. Sorry I'm late. Took longer than I thought.
No problem.
Martina gives Caden a small smile. He's only home for the night. She knows she's lucky he agreed to meet her after finishing up at the station, giving a final witness statement to Holloway and Massey.
I didn't.
They both speak at once. Then Caden laughs.
You first, Jenkins.
Martina clears her throat and takes a small sip of coffee.
I wanted to apologize. I was really frustrated last winter with the way the investigation was going. I'm not sorry I kept bugging you for an interview, but the things I said in my boyfriend theory episode, they weren't entirely responsible. I was thinking about you as a suspect, not a person.
Thanks, Caden says. I appreciate that.
Martina breathes and leans back in her chair.
How was everything at the station?
You're not recording this, are you?
Caden leans forward, a small smile playing across his lips.
Scout's honor, Martina says. The podcast is on hold for now. I need to do some sort of final episode, but I'm not ready to go there yet. All this time, I've been trying to figure things out, get justice for Zoe's family. But then
the bad guy turned out to be Esther.
Yeah, something like that.
She drains her coffee.
Can I ask you something?
Caden nods.
The flash drive. Why did you leave it where someone could find it?
How did you?
Caden starts to ask.
Oh, right. Anna found it this summer, and the card for Zoe, right before the fire.
Huh.
Caden scrubs his hand across his eyes, then drops it to rest on the table.
Okay. Well, I found Zoe's flash drive in the stable a few days after she went missing. I thought she was angry with me, that she'd left town to punish me, escape for a while. I really thought she'd show up by the start of the semester.
He pauses, looks down at his hands.
Anyway, on my first trip home in the spring, I put it in the stall and wrote out the card, just in case. I didn't think anyone except Zoe would go looking there. But it was probably as much a reminder for me as it was an apology for her. Because I knew if she didn't come home.
For a moment, they're both silent.
And Tiana?
Martina finally asks.
Yeah, that never really got off the ground. After Zoe disappeared, it just got complicated and sad. We both felt pretty guilty.
I really am sorry,
Martina says after a minute. Caden shrugs.
Apology accepted. I think we both have some regrets. I just wish I'd gotten the chance to apologize to Zoe.
Martina stares down into her empty mug. A layer of milky foam lines the sides.
One more thing, she says, looking up. When I do put a final episode together, I want to include memories about Zoe from the people closest to her. Is that something you'd be interested in doing? Caden smiles.
Sure. That's the kind of interview about Zoe I'd be happy to do.
Thanks. Martina smiles back, then glances at her phone. I should get going. I'm kind of grounded for trespassing at your house last week.
Caden laughs. I think I'm going to stay and get a coffee. Take care, Jenkins.
Martina pushes back from the table and slings her book bag over her shoulder. Then she sticks out her hand, because it feels like the right thing to do. And Caden takes it. See you around.
Chapter 35. October. Bay Ridge, Brooklyn, New York. The lies started the moment I was born. Now that I'm home, I spend my days cleaving truth from untruth, sorting memories into the times and places they belong. I've been talking to Mom a lot about my early childhood, after hearing her stories, seeing the photos she kept hidden. I'm getting better at it. This face belongs here, in this year, this event happened there. In the daylight, I'm beginning to understand. Everything that got jumbled is becoming unjumbled. I can hold one piece of memory up to the light, look at it, examine it without the other memories getting in the way, churning things into the messy concoction that scrambled my brain this summer. But I can't shake the dreams. At night, I dream I'm in Pathways, curled up on my cot. I dream I'm inside Windermere, surrounded by birds. I dream I'm in the stable, and it's burning, and I'm burning with it. It's almost Halloween. In Bay Ridge, some of our neighbors have gone all out with their porch and lawn decorations, as they always do. There are full-scale scenes of witches and zombies, murder and mayhem. I don't look too closely. When Mom sends me out to the store, the laundromat, to Duane Reade, I keep my eyes on the sidewalk, where the crisp browns of autumn leaves have begun to scatter. I wrap my scarf twice around my neck and button my denim jacket, relishing the chill in the air. It's autumn. I'm outside. SUNY New Paltz let me defer my start until the spring semester, given the circumstances. My new leaf will have to wait a few months, but it's okay. I'm home in Brooklyn. I'm free. Today I don't have any specific errands on my agenda. I'm just walking, listening to the crunch of leaves beneath my feet, letting the familiarity of the houses and apartments I pass wash over me, letting the memories come. This first one isn't a memory so much as a story Mom should have told me a long time ago. She said it was her secret to keep, but I think she's beginning to understand it was mine too. Now that we can finally talk about it, Mom says she knew the second she had me. I wasn't the daughter of her husband, John. I was the product of Mom's on-again, off-again summertime affair with a mostly laid-back landscape architect with an occasional temper who she'd met on one of many summer vacations to Heron Mills. Because we had been to Heron Mills. John wasn't cheap. He just wasn't a very good husband. He'd spend most of their vacations ignoring her, absorbed in his work, and eventually, she found George Spanos. There was no Stone Harbor. It was always Heron Mills. It explains a lot about my mom's reaction when I told her about the nanny job, why she didn't want me to go. She was so afraid I'd run into George or Zoe, who she didn't even know was missing. That they'd see, after all this time, that I was theirs. Because Mom never told anyone the truth about my paternity. Not John, even when they divorced. Not George. And certainly not me. To hear her tell it, we were fine on our own. We didn't need John, and we didn't need George either. who by the time my parents split had reunited with his wife Joan. I get that, but she still should have told me. If she had, surely none of this would have happened the way it did. After I confessed, when I swore to Mom that I knew Zoe, that we'd spent time in Heron Mills together last winter, she believed me. Of course we'd found each other again. I can understand now why Mom thought my story was real. It's the same reason it all made sense to me. It's true that I drank too much and blacked out often. It's true that the police used to bring me home. There was just enough truth to my story. It made it all seem real. After hearing Mom's stories, here's what I know was actually real. I'm 3, and Zoe is 5. Zoe is my summer friend, 2 years older and infinitely wiser. Her dad and my mom take us to get ice cream at Jenkins Creamery on Main Street while my dad works. Dad is always working, laptop open on the desk in the little house we're renting, papers spread out, phone pressed to his ear. Dad is a businessman, which means he's always busy. I'm happy Mom has a friend. Happy I have Zoe. I order chocolate with sprinkles and a waffle cone that Mr. Jenkins promises won't leak because there's hard chocolate hidden at the bottom. Zoe orders the same thing she always orders, the featured flavor in the bright blue box on the chalkboard menu, chocolate caramel popcorn. In a cup, she insists, even though it's better in a cone. Zoe doesn't like to get ice cream on her face, prefers to eat it neatly with a plastic spoon. Her dad laughs as we leave the ice cream shop and turn onto Main Street. My face is already covered in chocolate, while Zoe dabs at her clean cheeks with a napkin. My little princess, he calls her. We're at the Glaston pool in Zoe's backyard, stationed on the lounge chairs with the soft plum cushions. It's late afternoon, maybe 4 or 5, the hottest part of the day. I'm wearing a bright blue bathing suit with little white stars splashed across the fabric. Zoe is wearing her yellow two-piece, her favorite. Her dad has the air conditioning cranked up, the cool air cutting the thick mugginess in here. He's sitting on a porch swing behind us with Mom, sipping cocktails and laughing. Zoe and I have our own cocktails, pink lemonade and fizzy water and ice. Lemon spritz, her dad calls them. A little yellow parasol rests on the rim of Zoe's cup, but mine has a lid, so I keep my parasol on the lounge chair beside me. Belle, Zoe's Bichon Frise puppy, is flopped across Zoe's feet on her lounger. I wish Belle would come visit me, but she's drawn to Zoe like a magnet, always wants to be close to her. Zoe has a way with animals like that. Even the squirrels don't run away when she goes out in the yard to sprinkle seed along the garden wall. Where's your mom? I ask, and Zoe takes a long drink. She works in the city, she says finally. Daddy says her job is very important, so she has to live there with my little sister for a while. I'm going to visit them at the end of the summer, but Daddy will stay here. They're taking a break right now. She surrounds the words with air quotes. My dad has an important job, too, I say. He's very busy. That's why he can never hang out with us. Zoe nods solemnly, and I wonder if my parents will take a break. But they both live in the city. Where would Dad go? All at once, the sky darkens, and a long streamer of lightning strobes across the sky above the glass ceiling. While the light is still bright in our eyes, thunder cracks, loud and very close, and Zoe screams. I stare at the sky above us, fascinated, as rain starts pelting the glass. It's okay, I tell Zoe, but she's already curled in a ball, her lemonade pooling on the floor beneath our chairs. Mr. Spanos snatches her up and takes her inside, promising that the storm won't hurt her, that they'll wait in the hall closet together until it passes. Mom sits next to me on Zoe's abandoned lounger and slips her hand into mine. "You okay, Pumpkin?" she asks, and I nod. "Why is Zoe afraid of storms? They can't get us in here." Mom shrugs. "Lots of kids are afraid of thunder and lightning. I'm glad you're not. Hopefully it'll pass for Zoe soon." I'm on the balcony at Windermere. It's late afternoon. Late summer. The last summer my parents will vacation in Heron Mills. The day is bright and cloudless and thankfully not too hot. The Talbots are throwing one of their classic parties, an end-of-the-summer bash. Mom is sipping a glass of rosé and chatting with the wives of George's friends. My dad is downstairs, in the back, walking out where it's quiet, by the stable and riding pen, so he can take a business call without the nuisance of the party getting in the way. If Mom and George are being too obvious, flirting and chatting, my dad's not around to notice. I'm playing with Zoe and Caden near the balcony's southeast corner. Caden is our audience, although not a very good one. He's 5, like Zoe, and quickly distracted. They know each other from school, but today will be the first and last time Caden and I will ever meet. For 14 years, that is. Zoe and I are standing with the balcony rail to our backs, reciting part of a poem she's taught me while Caden fidgets with his bow tie. "No time hath she to sport and play, a charmed web she weaves alway. A curse is on her if she stay, her weaving either night or day, to look down to Camelot. She knows not what the curse may be, therefore she weaveth steadily. Therefore no other care hath she, the Lady of Shalott." I trip over the strange words, but Zoe knows them by heart. She learned them from TV, from something called Anne of Green Gables, which Mom says we can rent at home, if she can find it on Netflix or at the budget rental place near our apartment. She says I'm too young for it, but I don't care. If Zoe loves it, I'll love it too. As soon as we finish the passage I've learned, Caden darts off inside the house, leaving Zoe and me to entertain ourselves again. She reaches for my hands, and then we're twirling on the balcony, arms crossed in an X, spinning and giggling. Zoe's laugh a glittering sunbeam in the summer air. I'm in a white party dress with a yellow sash, because Zoe says yellow is the prettiest color next to gold. Zoe is wearing a ballerina dress, shimmery gold top attached to a cream tulle skirt. We wear matching pink barrettes in our raven hair. We twirl and twirl, and the sun dances like snowflakes on our skin through the lattice of the tall maples and oaks. 2 strong hands take hold of my waist, and suddenly Zoe's sitting on her bottom on the balcony while I'm being lifted up, up, up in the air. The hands dangle me over the balcony rail, and I whimper as the ground below swells and buckles.
"Tell me who her father is, Gloria."
"What the hell are you thinking?" Mom's voice is a hot whisper, the panic hovering right beneath her desire to deflect the party's attention away from us. The ground swells again, a roiling, churning wave. "We're just having fun." A whisper in my ear, whiskey thick on Zoe's dad's breath. "Don't be afraid, Anna." "George, put her down, right now." In my mother's eyes, tears gather, then spill over. Below me, the grass surges and retreats. My whimpering gets louder.
"Just tell me the truth, Gloria. I'm her father, aren't I?"
His palms are slick with summery, boozy sweat. They begin to slip against the shimmery fabric of my dress. I squeeze my eyes shut and silently pray he'll put me down, that this will all be over soon. Then his hands slip again, and for a second I'm falling. Everything goes out of focus as I pitch down, body twisting in a flash of yellow and white. Then his hands tighten around my baby fat arms, and I'm dangling. I press my eyes shut, and he pulls me up, back onto the balcony, back to safety and my mom's wet sobs. After that last summer, we don't return to Windermere. We don't return to Heron Mills. Mom resolves to make things work with Dad, but 2 years later, he leaves for a better opportunity. Something better than us. L.A., Mom tells me now. We move to a small apartment in Bay Ridge. Mom starts working one job, then two. I forget Zoe, mostly. Mostly, I forget Heron Mills. Until 14 years later, when I am offered a plum gig at the Bellamy Estate, and bits and pieces of my early childhood start to catch at the corners of my eyes like wisps of shadows at the end of a long summer day. Now I'm taking one day at a time, allowing Mom's stories and pictures to pull my memories more clearly into focus. I turn the corner onto 82nd, pass by the fruit market, the house with the purple awning. Kaylee found an apartment in Queens with Ian, which is okay for now, and she's busy with community college, which is great. No one has heard from Star. We've retreated back into our guilty silence. Maybe she faked her death. Maybe she's living a new life somewhere amazing. I looked it up. People do it more than you'd think. I need to believe it's possible. Although deep down, I know the truth. Martina and I text every day. She's going to come out to Bay Ridge to spend the weekend with us, as soon as her parents agree to let her come. Hopefully by January, when I move up to New Paltz, there will be a new podcast everyone's listening to, a new case to push the name Anna Ciccone far, far into the background. Most nights, when I'm lying in bed and trying not to fall asleep, delaying the dreams I know will come, my mind wanders to Zoe and Aster, my sisters, the short gasps of time I got to spend with them both. Now that I understand who she was to me, I want Zoe back more than ever. She was my summer friend, and so much more we didn't realize. Our parents' secrets like a river running between us, pushing us to opposite banks, pushing us apart. Aster was only a baby when our parents had an affair. If I ever met her when we were kids, I don't remember it. Sometimes I think of her, and my vision goes white with fury. How she let me sit in pathways for 2 months. How she must have hoped my confession would stick, that she'd get to keep the real story locked inside her heart. But then I remind myself that, in the end, she did the right thing. She's lucky. She'll be held at home until trial. I'm glad she's not in juvie, like I was. But I know things still can't be easy. I'd like to visit her, but I'm not ready yet. Someday I will be. After all, she's the only sister I have left.
Chapter 36. October. Heron Mills, New York. I have a secret. It's not dirty, or little, or some cutesy catchphrase. It's caustic, noxious, burning me from the inside. I killed Zoe. And it was a terrible, terrible mistake. It began last year, when Mom had surgery to fix a torn rotator cuff. After the procedure, her doctors prescribed this painkiller Demerol, which she only took one time to get through a dinner party she was hosting for Wayfair and Ramble. In typical Mom fashion, she refused to cancel it, even though she was barely out of the hospital and Dad said she needed to rest. Mom drank that night, some champagne, then too much red wine. I watched her stumble into the bathroom, and the running water didn't do much to block the sound of her retching over the toilet. After that, Mom shoved the Demerol to the back of the medicine cabinet and switched to Advil instead. I wasn't trying to kill anyone, and that's the God's honest truth. Like I told the detectives, I wanted to punish Caden for breaking my sister's heart. But there's some stuff I didn't tell. When I got to the stable that afternoon, the open bottle of whiskey was less than a quarter full. At first, I didn't pour that much Demerol in. It was the liquid stuff. Smelled a little like bananas. I started with a few drops, but then I drained the bottle. I figured Caden would come home from the city, find the flash drive, and decide he needed a drink. It was a perfect plan. He'd pour himself a glass of whiskey, and it would make him sick. Poetic justice. But it didn't happen that way. What I told the police about getting a bad feeling in my gut that night was true. But I wasn't just feeling guilty about the flash drive. I knew I'd gone overboard. I'd poured too much Demerol in. Of course, I was way too late. By the time I got there, she'd drained the last drop from the bottle. Demerol, whiskey, the prescription meds she took for astrophobia and generalized anxiety, the combination was deadly. I'm sorry, Zoe. I'm so, so sorry. When they found her body, there was so little left of her. The coroner wasn't able to confirm the presence of Demerol in her bloodstream. But I know. I killed my sister. It was a mistake, the worst mistake possible. But they never would have ruled her death an accident if I'd told the whole story. The truth's out there now. A version of it, anyway. Another tragedy for people to ogle and judge. But there are some secrets, my secrets, that Windermere will hold forever, trapped beneath the ash like spilled blood.
I Killed Zoe Spanos was written by Kit Frick and read by Jenny Barber and Jamie Mattler, with Dan Bittner, Ines del Castillo, Jonathan Davis, Gibson Frazier, Madeline Mabey, Sanila Nankani, Jackie Sanders, Candace Thaxton, and Jesse Valinsky. Editing and post-production by Charles de Montebello. The associate producer was Claire Tadokoro. I Killed Zoe Spanos was produced and directed by Michael Noble. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. I Killed Zoe Spanos is available in print from Margaret K. McElderry Books.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.